Hello, listener. Welcome to the Messy Truth podcast. I am Gavin, and I'm here, as always, with Megan. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Gavin. Hi, Nikki.
Hello, Nikki.
Hi, Gavin. Hi, Megan.
And we have invited another expert to join us for this episode. Here with us today is Simon Court. Hi, Simon.
Hello. Hello, Gavin. Hello, Megan. Hello, Nikki.
Nice to have you with us. Appreciate you coming on. So, Simon, tell us just a little bit about who you are, you know, 1 or 2 minutes about who you are and your experience, and then we'll frame perhaps the conversation we're having and see where it leads.
Okay, thanks. So about me, so I have three sort of hats. One is the newest hat is an author. I'm also a founder of my own business, and the thing I do most days is work as a leadership team coach. So just briefly about those three bits. The author bit is I've recently published a book called Founder's Legacy, 50 Game-Changing Leadership Lessons for Building a Great Business. So it's a leadership book for founders, which we'll probably talk about more in a minute. The founder bit is I set up my own leadership consultancy practice 25 years ago with my wife, and I'm now chair of that. It's based in London and we do work around the world. And the leadership and team coach, I've been doing that for the whole of that period. In recent years, more and more with founders, and that's partly a preference and it's partly how the world and our business has evolved, I guess. And during that last sort of decade or so, I've been involved in building two unicorns, one British, one German. So they're probably not going to be so familiar to an American audience, but it's been a very interesting experience nevertheless.
Brilliant. Thanks. So let's get into that a bit. We'll talk a little bit more about the book later, but your cumulative wisdom is in the book. So we'll get into that a bit later. But let's just start as you why founders? What is it about them as leaders of people that you find interesting? And interesting enough to kind of spend some time thinking about this and writing about this.
Okay, so I think over that period, I started to notice they had some different qualities about them. I just a health warning about generalization. Every time you generalize about something, you'll be caught out discovering people are actually different from that stereotype. So please accept the health warning. So what makes founders a little bit special and sometimes tricky to work with and maybe work for as well? So they're often very driven people, right? They have some purpose or some mission that they are really energized by. You might call them game changers. They're very attached to their idea, and they can be quite unrelenting in pursuit of that, of course, which sometimes makes it hard for others to work with them, follow them, influence them. They typically are, in my experience, very focused on solutions rather than processes. And a lot of the time when you work with people in corporate settings, they can be quite process driven. They're thinking carefully about things like governance. They're thinking carefully about how we're going to manage the strategy process, how we're going to get all the stakeholders engaged and involved and come up with the most reasonable, thoughtful, sensible outcome for the business. Founders are a little bit more unpredictable than that in my experience, and they operate without the same constraints on them, I think, especially if they own most of the shares and they're still very much in control of their baby. And it often feels like that, I think, when you're dealing with a founder, that you're talking about something that is their life's work. And I have to admit, as a founder myself, there were times when people wanted to affect the way my business value partnership was going. I found it quite hard to hear that or to really take on board what people were saying to me, because there are certain principles, whether it be the purpose or the values, that I was very attached to and maybe still am. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, by the way. I think that's just the nature of the beast a little bit. Is there anything more? I mean, maybe there is one more thing, and I guess it's linked to why I ended up writing this book, that a lot of people in corporate life become a leader because they have an ambition to be a leader. Most founders I know are kind of accidental leaders. They didn't become a founder because they wanted to become a leader. They became a founder because of their sense of mission and purpose or their idea, and then found themselves in a leadership position. And so there's a certain amount of reluctance and intolerance, impatience with demands of the leadership job that seems to go with the territory.
That makes me think, Simon, of another conversation we've had recently. This idea of, accidental leaders. So in your experience, when you think about there are, I th the conversation we were having with Josh earlier, in a previous episode, was really all about the best founders are the ones who recognize either that they can go on and be an operator, or if they can't, they'll get a team around them to do all the things that require, that need to be done. So when you think about the unicorns or the other businesses, the other founders you've worked with, what is it that makes them realize that? What do they, how do they learn about themselves to know that, oh, I could become an operator and build it, or I can't, and therefore I need people around me?
That's a really good question, because I think in a way they kind of run into that wall and have a choice to make when they when they recover from bouncing off it. And we could talk about, of the two unicorns, of one of them in particular, Miniclip. And this is all in the public domain, so I can talk reasonably openly about it. Rob Small was the founder. He had built up, this is a gaming business. It was mostly on the web at the time I got involved, in sort of 2012, 2013. And there was a the business was flatlining. There was the team that he had was not really equipped to take the business any further. There was huge growth in mobile, and Rob was looking enviously towards that, trying to figure out how to navigate that, because that would potentially unlock the kind of levels of growth he was ambitious for. And he was in a tough place. He wasn't sure how to act and how to move forward. And we were introduced at that time, and he had some of those qualities that you really wish for in a good coachee. As I recall, he was sort of very open with me about the nature of the problems that he faced. He was saying, if I could afford to hire a good CEO, I'd probably hire a good CEO, but I can't afford to do that. And I said, well, looks like you better figure out how to do this job then. So our kind of his realization came through quite early on in our coaching relationship. And I think his motivation was clear. He had there was a big prize available if he could step into that leadership role and recognize that the job of a founder, if he wants to go on the kind of journey that his ambition would take him on, he needed to step into that leadership role. Otherwise, he was facing failure. And so at that point, I talk about this a bit in the book. There's, in my experience, and this is sort of independent of coaching founders or anybody, I think, is I'm looking for probably three things in somebody. One is that they see themselves well enough to understand what's going on. You know, they have a sense of clarity about, okay, I'm struggling in that space. I'm really good in this space. So there's a sense of realism about that self-insight. And I think Raul had a pretty good sense of himself. If anything, he was probably, he wouldn't self-promote very much. He was quite self-critical. Secondly, you need motivation to change. You need to actually want to change. And Rob had ample reasons to be motivated because he was stuck and the business was stuck. And I think the third thing is to know what to do differently, to have a different option, a different pattern of behavior that would actually tend to be more fruitful. So he was very receptive to coaching at that time, and he made my job easy, really. I think it was something rather brilliant about his ability to rapidly develop. He had that growth mindset, which is sort of chapter one of my book. It's an essential ingredient for any successful founder and leader of all kinds. He had a lot of talents that could be brought out. And I think then you mentioned teamwork, Gavin. I mean, I think the second big ingredient of a successful change process at Miniclip was he could see, and he didn't need much nudging from me, that the team he built around him simply wasn't capable of taking the business to the next stage. And that probably was one of the hardest things for him, because these were people who had given their heart and soul for the company. Some of them were personal friends. He made that very familiar founder mistake of hiring people that he knew and trusted rather than who were really into what they needed to do. Right. And so we couldn't afford to change it all overnight. So we just made some tactical decisions. Where are we going to start? And we decided we'd start with a new CFO because he had some financial issues and a contract that wasn't working in the United States, and we needed to renegotiate it. He was stuck, didn't know how to do it. So let's bring in a CFO who can start to take things off Rob's plate and help him to start working on the business rather than in the business. And I had to gradually draw Rob away from dealing with things that are not really the domain of a CEO, like tinkering with a product and trying to stop his co-founder from fiddling with a website, when actually there were much bigger fish to fry in terms of how we're going to pivot to mobile and how we're going to really build a world-class business. And so that was a little bit, if you like, some of the early stages. I mean, I just to finish off on this bit, so you get a chance to ask another question. I think leadership is hard, right? Transitioning from being a founder into being a leader, not all founders are capable of making that transition or are motivated to do it. Rob kind of had a sort of needs must approach to it, but actually he became an exceptionally good CEO, I would say. And I have known quite a lot. And I think he knows now that leadership matters much more than most founders realize. And if you look at what causes failure, because the stats are all over the internet, I think something like 90% of startups fail within maybe the first 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be a little bit nuts to do it. And one of the, if you look at all the reasons that people say they have failed is lack of product market fit, or we ran out of money, or whatever it is. But all of those things are actually the decisions and the behavior of the leadership, the founder typically, or founders, and their inability to build a team, their inability to be clear and focused with their strategy, not making smart decisions about fundraising. There's a whole host of things. If you can get your ego out of the way and make some sound decisions and operate a bit more like a CEO and a little bit like a bit less like a rather self-obsessed egomaniac with the only way is my way, you can do amazing things and do really good things in the world.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It gave me such a vivid picture, and it prompted many, many thoughts. What I heard in some of that story, Simon, is first of all that this was a person who knew enough about himself that A, he hired a coach, okay. We'll stop there. And B, that he was in trouble and was receptive to help and knew that he was part of the problem. So that to me is very striking. I love the way that you said people go into corporate world to become leaders, but founders, it's a very different wiring. And I think we do find in the corporate world many leaders who look like some egomaniac. Founders, right? Who their idea is best and they get their hands in everything. Psychologist by training here. I think that can you provide any insight? Because I know we coach a lot of folks that work in these startups. I mean, at MIT, there's a whole huge startup and helping students figure out how to start their businesses, and they're there at MIT to meet their business partners and do these things. And so there's the first early stage, once they've got the money together, and it's that small tight group. And we all advise, please don't hire all your friends, et cetera, and don't get the money from all your friends. And we give the same guidance. But so then there's the messiness of that initial team. But then as and everybody's kind of, in that high energy thing, but then there's the move into like, we're really going to form a business now, okay? Which is a different gear. What, from a psychological perspective, how do you get that founder type person mentality, okay? The mission and the driven, and I have a better idea than anybody else out there. I'm going to be unique in some way. How do you, were you successful at getting any of these founders that you coached to be mindful that there are other human beings in the room that may also have good ideas?
this is where I start thinking about the diversity of people I've been working with rather than their commonalities in a
Right.
way.
Yeah.
I know for podcasts, long pauses are not great, but I'm actually trying to think about how best to answer your question. So I let me just talk about another person I coached who didn't start from a founder background, but went into the world of founders, because it's quite interesting to see this thing almost through the other end of the telescope. So this is this is my German story. So the four founders of Tipico, which is a sports book, in a very underserved market in Germany, it came very late to things like sports betting. The four founders were, I would call them, proper entrepreneurs. They kind of operate in almost like a Wild West setting in the early stages of a new marketplace, and a lot of quite his borderline rogue behavior from customers, suppliers, partners. It's a really kind of slightly edgy world. But they recognized that they weren't able to take their business to the next stage. So they were kind of just saying, well, I'm no interest in management, really. And Jan, my client, CEO, he came from Electronic Arts from a large corporate context. And he moved into this world. And he was surrounded by, there's no governance, there was no clarity about the brand, cultural identity of the business. There was no management tradition whatsoever. It was sort of chaotic. And Jan just called me because I'd coached him previously, and he said, can you come in and help Simon? So I went in there and I discovered all sorts of weird things happening. Like they would, we're gonna try and launch in the Italian market, and we're gonna market into the Italian market. And but none of the teams, different teams, knew what the others were doing. So they'd launch a product for the Italian market. Italian people would pick up the phone or contact the company, and there was no support set up for them. There was no language provision. There was nothing because nobody was talking to each other. So we had this business of trying to create, goes back to what you were saying, there's a businesses have to go from being a, as Rob called it, a scrappy startup into a more, for better words, professional, organized, controlled environment or semi-controlled environment. And so, you know, I think that, and Jan had this problem of adapting to that world because he'd come out of an environment where everything that you would expect to be there is there. If you know, there's an HR process, there's a finance process, there's a marketing engine that sort of more or less works. And you have to build all of that from scratch in a startup. And that means that for a founder, I mean, Jan knew how to build those things because he'd seen them all. He'd worked with them. He had an idea what good would look like. So his learning was how to right size his experience and pick up the pace. Because if we worked at the speed of Electronic Arts, Tipico would still be about a tenth of its current size. We had to move much quicker than a typical corporate would behave in that type of environment, that type of marketplace. So a lot of that was about, it's, this is, I think, what happens when people try to adapt to an environment they're unfamiliar with. Jan had to try to adapt to a founder environment. Rob had to create an unfamiliar environment, a more professional, organized, systemic environment where a focused strategy would be executed by a team and would deliver results over time. And it's sort of how you adjust. And if you don't have a growth mindset, if you don't have a desire to build a team around you, if you don't have an understanding that we need something that's focused and clear strategically, and if you're not driven by that sense of purpose that founders bring that is rather special to founders, you won't succeed. You've got no chance. So I don't know if I've answered your question, though, Nikki.
Well, what I got from it is you really have to have a growth mindset. You have to be receptive to shift gears because the business will require it.
The business requires it. And actually, thank you for saying that because it helps me to sort of articulate what I'm trying to say. That, I mean, if you're in that kind of business environment, doesn't matter whether I'm talking about my mobile gaming company or my sportsbook company, they were both in quite unstable environments. There was a lot of growth, but a lot of uncertainty as well. And we know that in order to operate in a VUCA world, we need constant learning as a business. So a lot of my communication with Jan and Rob was about, you know, if the business environment requires this constant adaptation and tacking to make sure that you respond to changes, trends, threats, opportunities, it doesn't make sense that a leader is stuck with one trick up their sleeve or one mindset or one obsession. So I think that the more growth-oriented founders recognize that their own learning is an essential ingredient in their business's ability to adapt to the changing environment that it exists in. And the more capable they are of learning and growing and adapting, the longer they will be able to stay in the CEO role, because they will not lose their relevance. They won't let their business down. They will listen. They will learn. They will have enough humility and enough smarts to guide their business through this phase and period of, particularly that period of scaling and rapid growth. So their own growth mindset and learning ability is absolutely pivotal to their firm's ability to thrive and survive.
Yeah, it's a key strategic capability for the business is the founder's growth mindset.
Well,
Is what I
exactly, because the progress is uneven, talent comes and goes, markets change, the economy tanks, we have a pandemic. How are you going to navigate all of that if you're emotionally and intellectually stuck?
Right.
Yeah.
And so what's your experience then? Do they cut because the part of the learning is about people skills, right? I mean, founders' brains are, I think their attention is not necessarily on people, it's on an idea. And so how do you teach them how to learn and grow around, but you have to do, your idea can only be actualized with other human beings.
So I think one part of that is that as the business starts to grow, because I think in both of these cases, when we put in place some critical elements, and the two most critical, I would say, are a team that's capable of building the company, and a strategy that's focused enough to start delivering the kind of flywheel effects of growth. Once we had those two pieces in place, the founder CEO finds him or herself in a new place, because they no longer have to stick their finger in the pie to try to make things happen. It starts to have its own momentum, and they start to bring in specialists to deal with HR, specialists to deal with finance, specialists to start building the marketing engine of the business and to build out the brand and things like that. So the more of that that happens, the more the founder CEO has to decide, okay, so what's next for me? Now, the thing, their greatest source of leverage, I think, as a CEO at that point is, how do I inspire and get the best out of the people that we have in our team? Not just the immediate leadership team, although obviously they're pivotal, but how do I create a culture which, when I turn my back, I'm confident that they'll do the kind of things that I believe are essential for us to continue to build a healthy, productive company and to do good things in the world and to be a good economic engine. So I think they find themselves through the natural evolution of their business, dealing with a lot of people issues. Now, that's not necessarily, as we might say in England, everybody's cup of tea, but a lot of my coaching conversations with founder leaders at that point is about how to get the best out of the people around me. So a lot of our conversations about, let's talk about what she's really like, what really motivates her, what gives her a sense of play, purpose, and potential growth. How can we get the best out of her? So I think we naturally find ourselves, because it's an essential ingredient in building a successful business, talking about those issues. And if they're really not interested, I think there's a real choice for them to make about I need to step aside. I need to find a new CEO. And that might be forced on them by their investors anyway at that point, simply because they can see what's happening and they can see that this is not going to be sufficient to continue the growth of the company.
Makes sense. Thanks.
When you're having those conversations with founders, can you talk about, I'm curious about the resistance points. I mean, I think about sort of certainly control comes up, right? And I think a big fear, right, is losing control of my baby, right? This thing that I've had so much control over, the culture is going to change, right? Maybe the values will change. Can you talk a little bit about those conversations and other points of resistance that you notice come up for founders?
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody once told me, and this is long before I started working with founders, that managers fear two things. One is losing control. The other is losing face. And there's a bit of wisdom in that. I wish I could remember who told me that. I think for founders, losing control is the probably the big one. Now, there's a sort of objective sense that control is about, you know, shares. And so there is a lot of... you have to kind of wean them off the idea that I've got more shares, therefore I'm in control. Therefore, I put my ace of spades down on the table when I don't feel I'm getting my way, or even if I'm losing the argument, I'll still play my trump card. It doesn't work very well, and if you surround yourself with talented people, they will lose patience and tolerance of that very fast indeed, and they begin to realize that. There's also this, you know, this thing, the things that founders bring, especially in the early stages of the business, this sense of passion and commitment to their baby, this desire to not let anything bad happen to it, this sort of kind of fundamental raw commitment that is something completely unfamiliar to a lot of corporate settings where it's just a job, right? And I'll say all of the right things and I'll show up and do the corporate PR, but if I get a better offer or whatever, I'll move on. So I founders are not like that. So they will be watching cash. They'll be kind of all over it. And of course, those things which are absolutely essential to the survival of the young child become actually the enemy of growth as their baby matures and becomes more of an adult. And so a lot of that resistance to letting go, I think we have to tackle that at that point when it becomes a problem. You can't tackle it before it's become a problem. When it's a problem, then we need to talk about it. And my experience of it is to deal with it one problem at a time, rather than to try and describe it as an existential threat to the future of the entity, and therefore you need to fundamentally let go of all of the things that you hold dear. So gradually, as you get somebody who's super competent running the finance team, they'll start to relax and let go a bit. When the product is in safe hands and you can see the progress that it's making, and actually you start to be impressed by the things that you're seeing, you think to yourself quietly, I didn't see that. Maybe I couldn't come up with that. You begin to let go. And when it comes to the behaviors, that's where the coaching becomes super valuable to them, because you can actually talk about practical behaviors that allow them to feel in control, but actually allow the individual people in the team to feel that they have a lot of agency. This sort of gives space, expect results. So focus on the results, don't focus on telling them how to get them. Create that opportunity and that space for them to perform.
You sort of drifted there into a question I had about self-insight, you know. So I was going to ask about how do you recommend founders or other leaders who already have a growth mindset to accelerate their self-insight, self-reflection insight about themselves? And the kind of that example you gave, I think it was a really good example, is, you know, the space and giving people space to do the work they need to do, and the behavioral aspect of, so if I need to, I can feel in control, but I can also behave in a certain way that enables other people to succeed, right? So yes. I can see that as a way of as a tool for self-insight, right? The coach is as a tool for self-insight.
Yeah, I'm one of those ingredients.
You are one. Are there any other recommendations that you give for generating self-insight for these folks?
Yeah, so feedback is, of course, quite handy. I'm not a massive fan of systematized 360 feedback with endless ratings, because it's sort of clickbait of another kind, really. I just feel like people don't necessarily really put a lot of thought sometimes into that. So we tend to use sort of more personalized feedback with much more open-ended questions. So I think that's very valuable. Set up in the right way, done at the right time. There's lots of kind of conditions, I think, to make it valuable to somebody. If they are more reflective, I encourage them to do a bit of journaling and self-reflection, particularly in between coaching sessions. I find sometimes that is quite interesting, to focus on certain things that they're going to practice and to keep a little diary for themselves about how they're getting on with that new approach or new pattern of behavior, particularly if they're, for example, trying to coach people themselves. That quite often comes up, that they realize that coaching is quite an important tool in their armory, potentially. And they become quite enthusiastic about coaching because they're receiving coaching and they're valuing it. So I quite often encourage them to pass that on, because it gives them a new way of connecting with their team. And I think when they do that well, they actually get a lot of feedback and insight about themselves, as we all do as coaches, I think, every time we coach. We also occasionally use tests. Now, I talk about a test called the GC Index in the book, which is particularly interesting for founders, called the Game Changer Index, sort of full title. And it focuses on behavior and your kind of energy for impact rather than personality. And I find it very interesting with founders. And in fact, that I talked to the originators, the designers of this test, and we looked at their data about how a founder's different from sort of more, I think they were called company directors in their sort of demographic. And they were very different, characteristically different. They both were capable of being quite creative. Company directors tend to be more strategic. They call them, in other words, their creative energy was more derivative. They'd build on ideas and find practical ways of making them happen. Whereas founders were more, are more game changers, more obsessive, and more focused on something radically, potentially game-changingly different. Yeah. So you see this striking difference. Now, we sometimes use that test to explore some of the other areas that they need to become stronger in. For example, the playmaker role. This is somebody, and I'm sort of the embodiment of this, and I'm guessing some of you are too, of the playmaker. Is basically, you're energized by collaborative endeavor and collective contribution. So you look at situations and problems and you think, who do I need to bring together to solve this problem, to work on this problem? How can I create an environment where they can do great work? And I think quite a bit of my coaching with CEOs is about making them more mindful of that pattern and that opportunity to really bring people together and to take a step back from having to lead and make decisions and listen, bring some humility into the room, maybe speak last instead of first, you know, things like that. And so feedback, journaling, coaching, a bit of testing. I think the greater the number of ways that you can triangulate, the more likely you are to get an accurate sense of self.
Yeah, absolutely. Fascinating conversation, Simon. Tell us a bit more about the book. So whatever you want to tell us, what's in it, and where people can buy it.
So I guess it really builds on this conversation that we've been having, is for sort of founders who want to become leaders and recognize that's important for them. And it's also for leaders who want to lead with a founder's mindset, picking up the other story I told you about Jan, who stepped into that founder's world and had to find a way of being more agile and more mission-led. I guess it's the book I wish I'd had when I started Value Partnership 25 years ago. And it's really designed to help founders find their own route to success rather than giving them some kind of formula that this worked for me, therefore it's bound to work for you, which is usually a crock of something. Mm. If that's okay to say that on the podcast. I mean, I really want founders to figure out who they are, how they want to be as a leader, and to find the right way to make their business a success. So it's, instead of 10 big chapters, it's 50 quite small ones. They're like an 8-minute read or listen. So, and at the end of each, there's a set of questions to challenge you to think about your own approach, your own practice, and where you could strengthen your practice. So it you can tell a coach wrote the book, and it's very much designed to help individuals to make their own decisions about how they could build their business and do it in a way that they feel has integrity and is authentic and will enable them to be truly successful.
Okay. And it's called The Founder's Legacy.
Called Founder's Legacy, 50 game-changing leadership lessons for building a great business. It's obviously on Amazon. Where else? And it's also available. I don't know what Audible are doing. They should have sorted this out by now. But it's on Spotify. Barnes & Noble have got it. You should be able to find it.
So Simon, they not only could they read it, but they could listen to you reading it.
I narrated my very own audio book.
So for those of you who enjoyed this conversation, go and listen to it. Fantastic. Anything else, guys, you want to raise with Simon?
I really appreciate the particular perspective on founders. And I learned a lot. Thank you so much.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much, Simon.
You're most welcome. It's been great chatting with all of you.
Appreciate you coming on, Simon. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now.